views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Najee Mweed, host of Race Treaty. We come to you every Friday evening, Eastern Standard Time at 9 p.m. Those of you in the electronic world, certainly you can contact us through www.blacktalknetworkradio.com/racetreaty. Race Treaty is a program that centers itself on ICERD, the International Covenant to Eliminate Discrimination. And also we know that you have to close the door. We have a little technical difficulty right now. Please bear with us. So Race Treaty is a program that looks at ICERD, the International Convention to Eliminate Discrimination. And of course, discrimination is just a very mild word for racism, and particularly looking at white supremacy, how white supremacy has dominated most of the world's markets economically as well as politically. And to see how we can use other human rights interventions to bring about a more just world. The program is a platform for people who are actually doing work to understand the dilemma we find ourselves in as a planet and how to unlock it, how to transform it, and in fact, even how to transcend it. And we are here to create a platform for people to bring to the listening audience their work, their ideas, their histories, their dreams, and their visions, such as the case tonight. We have with us our guest is Norman G. Curtin, J.D., founder and president of the Center for Economic Justice. We're naming our program The Third Way, and he will tell us why that is so, how it came to be so, that which is the platform of the Center for Economic Social Justice, CESJ. And we also will discuss with us what is this theory based on, who is this theory based upon, what it is its intended focus, purpose, and mission. So I'd like to welcome my brother, Norm Curtin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Anash. It's a great pleasure for me to be on the program with you.
No, actually it is mine, because John Oliver Killings said that we don't need sprinters, we need long-distance runners. And he's talking about the liberation of black people, in particular, and certainly the liberation of humanity in general. And you are such that you are a long distance runner. So please tell us a little bit about your life as a lawyer, as a social rights, as a economic rights, a human rights activist. Please give us a little background yourself so the audience will know who, in fact, they are talking to.
Oh, a little bit. I think I'd even have to go to my undergraduate work at the University of Connecticut, UConn, where we formed the first, what was called the first intercultural group. And clearly that did involve, to a heavy extent, that is, most of our members were members of a group I'm now involved with called Descendants of American Slaves. But it was, we were able to bring in all kinds of people. And that was a good beginning. This is back in the 40, about 1950, when we organized. And then I was in the military. That was during the Korean War, and I came in with a direct commission there, spent 5 years in the military. And that, too, was something where I had to deal with racial issues when I had several commands over in Japan as a young guy, a really young guy. And then finished that up and went into the law. I studied law at the University of Chicago. And then by 1960, I finished up and came to Washington because I was interested not in just going into the corporate world, I that just never interested me, but to try to wrestle with some of the major problems. And so I spent a couple of years in what was then called the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, mainly on education, segregation laws, because things were still a mess at that time, and poverty programs. But spent a couple of years there and went over. From that, I really got into what I wanted to do, and that was in civil rights. I went over to the, I became a lawyer in the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, working under Clyde Ferguson, who later became the dean of the Howard Law School. And Clyde was a brilliant guy. And we had a project that was called the Mississippi Project. So I spent from 62 to 64 in doing a lot of work in Mississippi. Came very close to Medgar Evers. And we were able to, we developed something called the federal presence theory. We had no power other than to write reports and hold hearings and that kind of thing, interview people. But what Medgar came up with was, we got to get these feds involved there, because no one thought that you could change the laws in 62 because the Southern senators were able to control the laws at that time. In any event, the idea was to challenge the system. And so when Meredith went into the University of Mississippi, Medgar said, "Norm, be there." And so I was there, interviewed him. The troops were there and all. But I spent a lot of time also with SNCC. And I became very, very impressed with SNCC. They went in and challenged the White Citizens Council in Greenwood, Mississippi, which was one of the roughest places, cities in the Delta. And SNCC went head on with these people. I can remember one day, Bob Moses, who was a leader there, asked whether I'd be there, and I was there. And they were going to have a demonstration on voting to issue a protest ballot where people would attend to register. And the governor had said, "Well, arrest everybody who's involved." So I went down there, and Bob Moses asked me if I would go and talk to the mayor and chief of police. So I went there while he was having a mass meeting in order to get as many of the people in the community to take the take the chance of going down there. You had television, all the major television stations were there waiting for the blood to flow. And so I went there, and I showed them showed the mayor and the chief of police my federal ID, and he thought I was working for Bob Kennedy, and I just was silent. Bob Kennedy had, and the Justice Department had all the power. But anyhow, he asked, "Well, what are you doing with a camera?" Well, I said, "I take pictures if anything happens." They said, "No, that's illegal." I said, "As long as nothing happens." And then finally, the mayor said, "Okay, you tell the people to go in, and if they come in there peacefully and go through the process of registering to vote, nothing will happen." And of course, that disappointed the media, because they wanted an event expecting that the blood was going to flow, but nothing did. But this is the kind of initiative. This is a small initiative. There were many things that was very exciting in my life right there in Mississippi. Now the problem was that by 64, Snake was very intelligent. They had students coming in from all over the country in the Mississippi. And they called it the Mississippi Freedom Summer. And so as a result of that, by 64, that year, Johnson felt the pressure to move for lifting the segregation laws, and they accomplished that, and also accomplished the war on poverty, which was supposed to be, and this is where a very important part of my life, because I became convinced that you had to involve the people. They had language in the poverty program that said maximum feasible participation of the poor, and I learned in Mississippi that when you organize the poor in a peaceful way, if you do it right, you can change things. And as I say, they did. From Mississippi and all the other southern states, SNCC was all over the place. And in any event, what you saw there was that no matter how difficult the legal system is, if it's unjust, then you do what Martin Luther King said. You organize in a peaceful way. Even SNCC, when you think about it, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, even though some of them, and I was very... I later got involved with Ed Brown, who was Rap Brown's brother. In any event, what I saw was the poverty program, which I went into, was a phony, I wrote the guidelines for maximum feasible participation, but then when the money was handed out, it was always from the top down rather than to help grassroots organizations. And I went out in California, I was sent out there, was given plenty of money, but it was always to the grassroots groups. And that made me suspect or not playing ball according to the way things are normally done. So I saw how phony that promise was, and I got ready to quit. And I'm leading to where what happened. I'm getting ready to quit, and somebody stepped into my office and said, "Have you ever heard of the ideas of Louis Kelso?" No, I hadn't. And he started to describe the ideas, and in 15 minutes, I said, "My God, why didn't I think of that?" You see, because the poverty program and the people trying to, the civil rights movement in general, their basic economic demands were for the government to create jobs and welfare. And so I saw what the results of that was. It was phony. And today, of course, it didn't solve the problem. But Kelso had an idea So I said, that's it. That's what I missed. I should have known this. And nobody would. But this was new. This guy had written a book, and that excited me when I first heard of the basic ideas, because what it did was say everyone should be an owner. In other words, own, which is the slogan of our group, you know, own or be owned. Own or be owned. And of course, most citizens of the world and in America are it's a modern form of slavery. It's called wage slavery, or welfare slavery, or charity slavery, or consumer debt slavery. You see that for students who go in, and some of them incur expenses if they want to get up and become a lawyer. Over $1 million of debt. And then they go out and find out that even the law degree is being displaced by artificial intelligence. They can do research with artificial intelligence. And so we're seeing the reality of the world comes down to economic power. That the vote, that political democracy doesn't work without economic democracy. And economic democracy means people have something that gives them power. And what Kelso said was, you either own or you're going to be owned. He developed a system where every citizen of the world, once you change the existing money system and tax systems, so that instead of government having the power, you spread it out to the people, or instead of a handful of capital owners owning it all, and they keep they move from being millionaires to billionaires to trillionaires, you have a mess, because the one thing you learn in property in your first course in law school is that property is not the thing you own. And of course, they treated people like things, and slavery was a form of treating people as things, not human. But there are things that are changing in the world, and that is that technology is changing. Who owns? The just third way.
Okay. No, you made a point and you didn't finish it. You were saying that in law school, when they talk about property, say the thing. You said the thing isn't the property, but you didn't finish the thought on that.
What property is the rights and powers and privileges you have, even the limitations of your rights with respect to things. For example, it gives you control or a share in control if you're owning something together with others. What's a key is a right to the fruits that are created because of that technology. See, Kelso developed a theory. He called it, initially, we'll go into that, he called it universal capitalism or democratic capitalism. Well, we don't use that term anymore, and even Kelso abandoned capitalism, because that's thingism. Capital are the things that go into the productive process. It's natural resources, it's all your technologies. And what's changing in the world, from hundreds of thousands of years, are not people. When we talk about people, there's only one race. That's the human race. That's the way I look at it. There's no such thing as a race. They only use it to subdivide people. But if you want to make a world that is a just world, you have to unite people. And in ways in which they are empowered. The only way of address, so again, it's the right to the fruits, that's what property is, And it's not something, Marx, for example, said nobody should own. Because if you read his Communist Manifesto, he said that you could summarize his whole philosophy in a single sentence. He was against monopoly capitalism, but he said you got to abolish private property. And Kelso agreed with Marx that concentrated ownership would bring about a disaster. Not good. But he said, instead of abolishing private property, make sure that everyone can have property rights, private property rights, and right to earn an income from ownership. And it's only your legal system and your monetary system that gets messed up. And in any event, we can go into, you know, how everybody who have people who have nothing. So from the bottom up, you can have equality of opportunity to be owners. And that's the system that we talk about, the just
you know,
way.
I'm not opposed to people having the privilege or the right to own, but we must look at history. We must look at the laws that the United States government put in place to convince indigenous peoples who were on reservations that they had to, in fact, assume a plot of land, a single plot of land, and once they forced, that's what they did, they forced the concept of individual ownership onto indigenous people, and through that mechanism, they were able to eventually usurp the land, because yeah, that's what they did in 1800. So when we talk about the right to have ownership, we must look at it from a historical context, because not all people, in fact, believed in the concept of ownership, number one, and many did not believe in the concept of ownership of land, number two. So to say that individual private ownership is the answer may not be totally the ultimate solution, because we can see that that was, in fact, the methodology that was used to take a people who were living in communalism. So, you know, we're in a different stage of humanity now, but communalism I would see as being the ultimate way of people sharing the bounties of creation.
Okay, what you're really referring to is many of the Native American tribes were not settled in any place. The Cherokee, however, they were settled. Cherokee had a very, very advanced society, and they did believe in ownership. And then, of course, under Andrew Jackson, they you had the Trail of Tears, and they abolished or made it very difficult for Cherokees. Well, they killed many Cherokees on the way, but there were many of the tribes. They were out there. They were hunters, but they owned their own horses. They owned their own weapons, you see, and it wasn't communal ownership of those tools. So, but they were there without any specific location as being theirs. But it isn't that is. So we have to recognize that some people were mobile, And so they didn't have land. But you see, the interesting thing is land is finite in any event. But what you get when Lincoln, one of the most important acts, and it was part of his strategy for the Civil War, fighting the Civil War, was called the Homestead Act. You see, and there he wanted to get, because he wanted to get... Which was basically, Lincoln never said he was against slavery for those states that have it. He said he was against the extension to the new lands that were west of the Mississippi. You see, and so he said that if propertyless people from east of the Mississippi, when out there they could have 160 acres. And we know also about the promise of the 60 acres and a mule that was never kept. But that's another matter. The important thing is he, by providing people with 160 acres of land, what happened was American agriculture began to surpass that of other countries of comparable climate conditions. And as a result, they were able to free people, because this is the beginning of the real industrial revolution here, was your railroads were starting and manufacturing was starting. And so you move from ownership in the families that had those 160 acres to concentrated ownership of industry that was developed, and then you see, I think that had Lincoln not been assassinated, that he would have said, because he understood money, he understood the railroads, he understood, and even when he ran for president, he said every citizen should be able to become an owner. His speech in New Haven when he first ran for president. And so I think he would have said that there's a frontier that doesn't have any known limitations. It's called the industrial or technological frontier. And that's what, as we move away from strictly agriculture into the industrial frontier with the more advanced energy tools which we've developed, I think that's what we're talking about. But also for the land, whatever land, it shouldn't be owned by the state. It should be owned by the people. You see, so that there's no reason. Yeah, you can look at the past and say there have been injustices. No question about it. History is that of injustices. What makes things, when we use the term social justice, we're not talking about the problem. We're talking about what do you do to change the system, the social order. When we're talking about economic, which is the big, the relationship that you as a person has with respect to the social tools. Social tool, for example, government. God didn't create government. People did. Government is a social tool. And if it isn't used intelligent, if it's used the way the collectivists talk about it, then we're all dependent on government, and it's a natural monopoly. It has a monopoly over coercion, force, jails, and the ability to kill people that don't agree. And the more you become dependent on government, then you're going to have an unjust world. If you look at, there are good things in the beginning of America compared to the rest of the world, and bad things, the original sin of slavery. But we want to see that if you read the Constitution, the preamble starts with "we the people" in order to create perfect union.
Yeah, we the people, we the two persons right here, will take a station break. For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Race Treaty. Our guest is Norman G. Curtin, J.D., a founder and president of the Center for Economic and Social Justice, and we're just getting started. So we're going to take a station break. We ask everyone to stay where you are and call your friends and neighbors to have them join this radio program. So we're going to take a station break at this time. Please stay tuned.
Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Good evening. This is Onaje Moid, host of Race Treaty. And we're speaking to a long-distance runner, civil rights activist, Norman Kirtland, J.D., founder and president of Center for Economic and Social Justice. And this last half hour, he's given us a lot to think about, a lot to reflect on. So obviously this one show will be certainly not enough time to cover all of his points. So of necessity, we have to invite him back. But right now, we still have another half hour to go. I want to go back to starting where we left off with Norm had mentioned the beginning, the preamble of the Constitution, We the People. Now, of course, We the People was not all of the people that were here in America. In fact, it was just those white male landowners who considered themselves to be in control, in charge, and that's the We the People they were, in fact, building society for. Africans were not considered humans, nor were the indigenous people as well. So we know that from the beginning there was this question of, not just a question, it was really oppression by omission, by leaving them out of the social contract. Yusuf Kly, K-L-Y, has a book called The Anti-Social Contract, where he eloquently points out that oppression does not only happen through commission, but also happens through omission. And he summarizes this anti-social contract against indigenous people and against African people. Brother Norm is saying that he has another way to look at it. And I don't know if this is true or not, but if one way is looking at what Adam Smith was saying, if the second way was what Marx was saying, and then is it true there that this is the third way that was actually critiquing those former two economic paradigms? So what is the first way? What is the second way? And why do you call the work that you do the third way?
Okay. Norm. First of all, Adam Smith was not for monopolies. He was for a market system. He didn't use the term capitalism. Marx was an inventor of the term. Marx and the socialists of his time and communists were the inventors of the term capitalism. And capital are things. So if you really want to see how badly it is, as long as you recognize that capital assets, that's what they're talking about, who's going to own them, it's thingism. So that's the best way to say why the system doesn't have really moral value or just value. And one of the points I was trying to make is, in the preamble, after it says we the people, in order to establish a more perfect union, so there's never a perfect union, but it starts, all of history is imperfect, but rather the next two words are the key. They're supposed to establish justice. So that's why, and we have to see that justice means is based on the importance of every human being, the common good for every human being. You have to treat every person as with dignity and equal, not necessarily equal results, but equal opportunity. So that's where social justice comes in. It's also, a lot of people use the term economic justice, social justice to mean problems. No, they're principles. This is our difference from a lot of people on the left or the right. Although we've been able to attract communists as well as libertarians to support our ideas, because I think it's a moral issue as to whether or not you want power to be concentrated in a few, and the only way you do that is if your money system is controlled by a few. And that's what really brought about monopoly capital. And that's bad, but also the opposite is bad, because there, whoever controls the state then becomes the oppressor. And you have the dictatorships all over the world where a few politicians are able to control the system. So the answer is don't trust the state to do more than establish justice, keep some order, settle disputes. But people have to be in power, and power follows property, and the right to become independent. You see, what Kelso said is the wage system, and this is what most economists teach, is that the increases in the ability to produce wealth, they say it's labor productivity, as if labor is the only way you can produce things. It's not true. It's labor. Kelso called it binary economics, meaning binary is there's labor and then all the things or capital. He called them all the productive assets. And what's happening is that if you focus only on labor as the way you earn an income and let a few people get vastly more than they consume, you're destroying a law that goes back to Adam Smith, is Jean-Baptiste Say's law of markets. And he said, why do you produce? For human consumption. And how can you consume if it isn't produced? Very simple logic. You can't ignore that. So then the question is, if in fact robots and artificial intelligence and 3D printing and other advanced technologies are doing what human beings were doing, and we're going to have new sources of energy, who's going to own the tools that are going to be able to get you out from under dependency on coal and the fossil fuels, which should be stored in the ground, because people have invented new technologies to harness to get energy out of water, get the hydrogen out of water. So who's going to own this today and in the future? And how do we spread not only the social tools and social justice and economic justice? And what is economic justice? It involves, again, principles, a principle of participation. And that's where the fault is. But it's also the other side. There's two sides of an economic equation, production and consumption. So who's participating in the production? Well, as I say, many people are no longer needed work, and this is unfortunate. But if you grew the economy faster, there would be many people who would be brought back into work. But our economy is a slow growth environment. The only time it grows fast is during the Second World War. You had double digit, and there was no unemployment. You had 13 million people fighting in the military. And women and disabled people were went in, and you had double digit rates of growth. Why? Because the customers were there. Who's the customer? Government. They buy all the weapons that they could during the Second World War to win the war. You see? But why can't that be done for peace? Well, you can't do it unless there's people are able to earn enough to consume. In other words, consumption power. You better get another way in which people can earn. Not necessarily through their labor, but maybe for a generation or two generations. Yes, there'll be more jobs, faster rates of growth, without inflation. I mean, when I was a kid, the minimum wage was 25 cents. What did government do in the New Deal? Today, people are saying, government, give us $15 an hour. Well, why not $30 an hour? You see, what happens to prices? You see, it goes up. So the poor are the ones who are going to be most damaged by the system that we're now following. But a system wasn't created by God. The money system wasn't created by God. It was created by people. And if they made mistakes, and believe me, there are mistakes, because everything that I'm talking about could be done under existing the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which is there are provisions there to make it possible for capital credit. That is, people who have no savings, can't afford to buy part of the growth, they would be able to go to their local banks and borrow $7,000, and it would be insured, so they to buy newly issued shares that would be full dividend payout, full voting shares, so that very, very quickly you begin to finance growth that isn't there now. But you would also, as I say, you would be building consumption income. It would take a few years to pay for each year's block of shares. Every child, every woman, every man in the country from the bottom up would get the same allotment. From Bill Gates and Warren Buffett at the top, they'd get their $7,000 if they want to waste their time. To them, it would be a waste of time. But we can now, you can grow new cities. I worked in East St. Louis with Yvette Young, who was state representative there. We wanted to rebuild East St. Louis, and she had the plans back in the 70s. Buckminster Fuller was one of the giant thinkers in design science. They've named new elements after Fuller. He designed a new city. When I worked in Harlem in the 60s, we had the Central Harlem Council and Neighborhood Boards. We had some leadership there who really loved the Kelso ideas. And Kelso and Fuller were going to work together to build a new Harlem. This was back in 68. But while they had money to organize in Harlem from the Ford Foundation, they organized five neighborhood boards in Central Harlem, where you had youth representatives, you had adult representatives, and they were going to, or the economic people there loved what the Kelso ideas were all about, and we were going to finance and build a new Harlem. But then the Ford Foundation, they weren't ready for a just third way. They wanted to go the conventional route, and of course that didn't solve anything for the poor. But East St. Louis, we had something going for us there. This was Fuller had worked in 72 to develop what was called Old Man River City, but they couldn't raise any money in the 70s. And then the leader there, Yvette Young, a woman who was a leader in the civil rights, and she was number two or three state representative, the highest ranking. And so we were able to get a law through the Illinois House of Representatives to establish what we called a citizens' land development cooperative, so that the land for rebuilding, for building a new city, we had the plans from Fuller. He had died before that, and we had people from NASA bringing in new technologies, energy technologies, and we went to the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, and this all written up in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, that what we were trying to do, we had a lot of combination of things, and then what I find, and this is always true, she died. And then people going off in all directions. And so nothing is happening.
So these are some brilliant ideas, and even when plans were put in place, it seemed as if, well, history shows that they didn't find its full fruition.
Right.
It was Frederick Douglass who said that power is only wrestled through demand, right? That it may be a moral struggle, it may be a physical struggle, but it must be a struggle, because where there is no struggle, there is no progress. So there are forces in place that is hell-bent on keeping this unjust system in place to reap the benefits that they have since the beginning of this country. So how do you see the third way actually coming into existence, given the efforts that you have attempted in the past and seeing that they haven't come to fruition? What is new about the third way now, or possibilities? They talk about sometimes the Kairos moment, for special times when certain things come together that can produce something that hadn't been able to come into existence prior to that moment. Is this a Kairos moment?
Well, very quickly, Kelso and I were able to get the laws through the Congress by finding one leader. So you have something called ESOPs, or employee stock ownership plans. And for workers in the private sector, their companies, I've helped a company use bank credit, buyout, no worker put up a penny. And we bought Mid-South Building Supply in Springfield, Virginia. But there are thousands of these now because of the laws that we're able to pass worker ownership to get capital credit for workers. But we want to do it beyond the workers. All citizens should be able to get it. That's what the Capital Homestead Act is intended to do. Now, one of the things we're doing that I'm really excited about is that there's a group forming that's called the Descendants of American Slaves Incorporated, DASI. And there, they don't want to use terms like black or Negro or African Americans, but they're getting together, and the idea is that you will establish the kind of people power united around an idea that will not allow concentration of power, but will power tends to corrupt, remember, and the more concentrated it is, the more corrupt it's going to become, and the only way to solve that is to spread it out. Well, these people are buying in, they're involved with our Center for Economic and Social, this is all within, well, I guess I met one of the founders, Michorn Daniels, in Louisville, but in his people. But they're now organized. We're getting together groups, and they're trying to reach out to Danny Glover and Harry Belafonte and Spike Lee and others to get them behind the Just Third Way. Because we can't just depend on worker owners, as I say. And there's a bigger picture. You got to look long term. Work is necessary, but again, if we do it right, people will do work because their education system will be better, the health system, but particularly the education system, so that we begin to enable people to go into what was called the work of civilization. Politics should be going. The founders of this country didn't get paid to put together the Constitution. And politics, you see, if every citizen began to get ownership, they would still have to work. They would still want to work. Just for them. So you have to teach people what was called what Aristotle called leisure work, or the work of civilization. Art, music, teaching. If teachers became owners, wouldn't need the kind of pension costs that are bankrupting cities like Hartford. We have a Center for Economic and Social Justice in Hartford, but you got that problem all over, all throughout Illinois, California, and so on, because we haven't addressed the needs for people to become economically independent, and that means we got to be willing to go and have a half a million to a million people come to Washington and a peaceful demonstration at the Fed. We've had rallies at the Fed because that's where the problem is. The Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is the problem. They control money, and that money system no longer has anything behind it. besides government debt, government deficits. And government deficits now amount to $61,000 per citizen. You see, because, again, the economic agenda has to be changed. You can't have debt, and eventually we're going to be like Greece, where the government is going to be bankrupt because we're going to have more and more people hoping for Social Security and Medicare. But we have to have a plan to do something better to relieve them over time from the dependency on government as a source of their income.
So Norm, for those of you who are just listening in, this is Onajima Wade with Race Treaty, and our guest is Norman Kirtland, JD, founder and president of the Center for Economic and Social Justice. Their website is www.cesj.org, and the phone number to the organization is 703-243-5155. That's 703-243-5155. And again, the website is www.cesj.org. That is the Center for Economic and Social Justice. So, Norm, you're saying that that this third way is based upon the theories put forth by Kelser.
Kelso, his name is. You get free downloadable books, the two by Kelso and Mortimer Adler. You got our book on the capital homesteading for every citizen. They're all. You can get a free download. We're an all volunteer operation, by the way, because we have to find other ways in which we earn an income. But I spend most of my time, believe me, probably 90% of my time at this time, for the work. And we've been all volunteer since 1984. We were formed in 1984, but I've been working with Kelso much before that time, since 1965, when I first heard of the idea. Yeah. And I welcome people to study, read this thing, ask questions, see if you can challenge it, because I have yet to hear somebody give me, and you go to our article section, you'll see a criticism by Milton Friedman. So you'll see my response to him. He didn't want to talk. He wouldn't give a reason. Or you could go to the video section and listen to the 60-minute show with Kelso on it. Kelso's dead now. He died in 1991. But you'll hear him on the 60-minute show after we're able to get the laws through the Congress. And you'll hear another Nobel Prize winner, Paul Samuelson from MIT, try to criticize, and you'll see how stupid he was just listening to the exchange between him and Senator Russell Long.
Okay, so those materials can be found on the website www.cesj.org. Well, folks, we've had this last hour of gracious sharing from this long-distance runner, Norman Kirtland, JD, who's been involved with civil rights for many years now, a number of decades. And in the beginning, when you was, and I asked you to speak a little about yourself, what question came to my mind is that what happened in your life that is so different from other, what happened in your life that is so different from many other white men who don't believe in social justice, nor have they given it any serious thought, and certainly not dedicated their lives for the resolution of these contradictions in this country called the United States of America. How did you come through these different levels of consciousness to become the person that you are?
Well, I was raised by a grandmother, and she was a good person, and she thought the way I'm thinking now. She didn't know about ownership. Believe me, a big move in my life was to discover Kelsey's ideas. I was looking, in other words, instinctively. I consider every human being as an equal and entitled, and this is very important that we allow people to. They're going to be different. Every human being is different, but you have to respect that and allow them to develop to their fullest potential. Our school system is terrible. You see, it's not teaching. Our academia is not teaching justice. They never talk about ownership. They tell you the reason you want to get a college degree is to get a job. In the meantime, as I say, those jobs are being destroyed by technology. Own the machine. Own or be owned. I don't know, you know. I can't think any other way.
Well, we want to thank you for your presence. You can't give us an answer. Is this something that just grew out of your own gravitation towards justice?
Yeah, well, you know, my wife, for example, was in the internment camps during the Second World War. She went over to Japan after her family got disgusted, obviously, what they went through, and so she finished up school there. She came here, I had worked in Japan. I knew her mother, and it turned out, you know, we met, and when we got married, we couldn't even get married in the state of Nebraska, so we had to go over to Iowa to get married. And a friend of hers was the Chief Justice of the Nebraska Supreme Court. So at the Officers Club, he was there. And then when we came and moved to Virginia after law school, again, we were subject to the miscegenation laws. But anyway, just being involved in trying to change a system which you know is not working, and you find out how it could work, then you have an obligation to try to help people understand until you get the people power necessary, not me alone, because that's why I'm depending on the descendants of American slaves organizing nationally, and that's what they're planning to do. And they're really good people, principal. One is in Los Angeles, another's in North Carolina, and then a whole bunch of people in Louisville, Kentucky. We got the people in Hartford, now Cleveland. We have people all over the country who know of our ideas, but it's going to take people who are ready to sacrifice, that is, to organize. That's it. That's how you establish justice. Without organization, and I'm talking about without violence, I want to see the young kids who go into crime, because I could have gone into crime. You see, I'm lucky. I won't say any more, but I'll say this. I can understand how people could go into crime, okay? But now we want those young people in the ghettos to become the leaders of the future, the millennials, so that they, if they take this idea and make it theirs, they will teach, and they will not only do it for the descendants of Americans, slaves of the Native American, but for every citizen. And therefore, they'll bring about a unity that will be a model for the whole world. I've been throughout Africa, and they like the ideas, but you got to get leaders. I got somebody writing me from Zimbabwe, for example, and there it's a democracy and justice new party. And you know, we're talking about what kind of laws should they have. We met with Pope J. John Paul II, we had the Solidarity People. This is before the Soviet Union collapsed. We had a presidential task force under Reagan. Reagan, and I was the deputy chairman of that. And we had the left and the right for a unified strategy called On the Just Third Way for Central America and the Caribbean. I was invited to the Soviet Union.
Norm, we're going to invite you back because there's much more we have to learn about this third way and equally about your organization, the Center for Economic and Social Justice. We want to thank you for your work, your contribution, and we have many more questions than answers. And we'll schedule another time, and some of the members that you mentioned, we can maybe get them on at the same time and see it. Because this program is really about building movement. And we see that you're very much a part of that. So we want to thank you very much. And thank our listeners for listening in. This is Onajima Weed reporting out from Race Treaty. Thank you and have a good night.